If you didn't get a handout, raise your hand. Put your hand out and we'll give you one. There's one up there. Now, originally tonight's schedule called for chapter 9 plus chapter 10, but chapter 10, which is a short chapter, fits in with the material in the next lesson better than it does with this material. So I've delayed that, and we're just going to cover chapter 9 tonight in the book of Revelation. It's the only scripture in the Bible that I know of, extensively anyway, that explains demons and sickness. And at first, when you read through that, you might not know that's what he's talking about, but it is. I think we can show that that's the case. And that's what we're going to look at tonight. When Jesus came, he cured people by driving out demons in some situations. And they were either ill or very much in distress. And when the demons were driven out, they were cured. So there's some connection there, and that's been kind of a mystery to a lot of people for a long time. So we'll look at that and look at the other verses in the Bible that relate to this. So Revelation chapter 9. Now on your handout, on one side, on the writing side of it, you have kind of a summary of chapter 9 that we'll talk about tonight and some of the conclusions that we draw from that. That's kind of interesting to see what it all means. And on the other side, we're going to start out looking at these diagrams about the age of the people that lived before after the flood. We've already looked at a similar kind of diagram of the ages of people before the flood. And before the flood, they lived how long? What was the oldest person that we know of? 969 years, and his name was Methuselah. And if you look at Noah went through the flood experience. How old was he when that happened? 600. That's right. Got some people over here that know their Bible. 600 years, it was his 600th year, the year of the flood. And after the flood, he lived 350 years. So how old does that make him? 950. You see, he runs second probably to Methuselah. And if the year changed its length, we don't have any idea whether it was more or less than 950 years. Can you imagine living that long? 50 years begins to get to people, and when you're 75, that gets to be kind of self-amazing. I don't know that how I managed that. And to live to be 100, what's the oldest that we live in this day and age? What's the upper limit, do you think? About how much? About 105. If you watch Willard Scott turning the jelly jar, do you ever watch that? We don't have people that... If you get old, you kind of watch that sort of thing. I don't. If you're young, you don't want to even think about it, I guess, being 110 or 114. Recently, someone who was the oldest person, documented person, was, I think, 114. The upper limit is about 120 worldwide. And there are some societies where people seem to live longer than in others. So we're going to look at that a little bit tonight. And we'll start out with a verse of scripture we've already looked at before. Whoa, I hit two of them for some reason. Back up. Genesis 6. Remember when people began to become numerous on the earth, it says in the sixth chapter, the Lord said, my spirit will not contend. What does contend mean? Put up with? Battle maybe, or strive, I think in some translations, with man forever, for he is mortal. His days will be 120 years. And so he's setting kind of an upper limit here. How old did Moses live to be? 120. That's kind of interesting. And Joseph lived to be 110. How old did Abraham live? 175. That's right. So we're going to find, if we look at the ages of people from the time of the flood on down to the time of Abraham, that it's gradually getting shorter. And one of the things is that the Lord didn't shut that off all at once, living hundreds of years, but he did it gradually. And we'll see a little bit about that as we proceed. So here's the top diagram on one side. And you don't have that red line in there because we don't have a color copier, but it's red in the one on the screen. That line under the descendants of Shem. See, Noah's at the top, had three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And Shem's descendants, if you follow that red line down, lead ultimately to Abraham, or to Abram on this list. So, how many generations are there there? Well, you can kind of count them. From Noah down to Abram is supposed to be 10 or 11 generations, depending on. I don't think you count Noah at the top. So there's four before we get Eber, and then there's five more down to Terah, and then plus Shem, and then plus Abram, I guess, is 11 generations. And so, the generations didn't depend upon how long the people lived. It depended on how long they lived before they had the next descendant, the son who would lead or direct the line onward. So, under that, once we get to Eber, you see the ones that are listed there. I mean, the writing's kind of small on the wall. Let me put my glasses on. We have our Arphaxad. And then who do we have underneath there? Canaan in italics, because he's listed in the New Testament, but he isn't listed in the Old Testament. That's kind of interesting that they knew of a name that belonged in that list that wasn't listed by Moses when he wrote this. And then Shelah and Eber. And Eber is the origin of the name Hebrew. Okay? The Eberites were the Hebrews. And then under the Hebrews, we have Peleg, Reu, Serug, Nahor, and Terah, ultimately leading to Abraham, or Abram, before his name was changed. So, and that's kind of an interesting thing that I gave you here. It shows you what's called the Table of Nations. What the Bible says were the individuals that led to these various nations of the world. And you'll see in the upper right, you have the Europeans, the Canaanites, who figure prominently in the Old Testament, in the lower right-hand part of that diagram. In the center part, you have the Africans and the Arabians. And then over on the left, you have the Hebrews and the Asians. You see, the Asians were sort of related to the Hebrews, with a common ancestor of Eber. So, I want you to take note of one named under Aram at the top up there. We'll see about him in a minute. Noah, Shem, Aram, and then someone named Uz. How would you like to be named Uz? And we will find a reference to the land of Uz in a minute. And that might be it isn't proof of the situation, but it might be quite similar to the case where the descendants of Canaan lived in, were Canaanites, and the descendants of Cushites. Now you'll notice in that list also one other one I was going to point out. I've forgotten it. We'll get to it in a minute. We'll get to it later on. But there are names in there you'll recognize in the Old Testament. From the name Heth, for example, you get the Hittites. And when you look over here at the descendants in Canaan, you'll find among the Canaanites, Girgash. And so in the Bible, you'll see reference to the Girgashites. And when you have Archites, and so on. And Amor, A-M-O-R, and then his descendants were called Amorites. And so you'll see those names. And it's kind of interesting to look at these names and see how they relate to other parts of the Bible. All right. Now, you would think from looking at that, if the next son came within 100 years or so, that you only have to go about 1,000 years from the flood to get to Abraham, to get to Abram. But when you put all of that together, as you have in the bottom diagram there, and you do that by looking at the scriptures in Genesis 11, where this table is given. 2 years after the flood, when Shem was 100 years old, he became the father of Arphaxad. And he lived 500 years, had other sons and daughters. When Arphaxad had lived 35 years, he became the father of Shelah, and it goes on. After he became the father of Shelah, he lived 403 years. And so that whole table is given there and allows you to put together the diagram at the bottom of that page. Okay? And that tells you how long each of them lived. Now, some of these tables and genealogies in the Bible don't tell you how long they lived, but this particular one, from the flood down to Abraham, tells you how long they lived. Now, there's some peculiar things about that particular diagram. Some in Genesis 10, you'll have some of these names with some comments. The sons of Shem, Elam, Asher, Arphaxad, Lud, and Aram, and that's where I got the names to put on this top diagram here. And he gives the sons of Aram, Uz, Hul, Gether, and Meshach. And Arphaxad was the father of Shelah, Shelah the father of Eber. And then a very important thing I've alluded to in the past. Two sons were born to Eber. One was named Peleg, or Peleg, because in his time, what does it mean in his time something happened? While he was alive, right? Is that the meaning of it? The earth was divided. And his brother's name was Joktan. But Peleg is apparently a very important individual in the series because this common comment is made about him at that point. Now, what I think that means is that the original landmass, which scientists call Pangaea or Pangaea, broke up into the individual continents that we have today. And as they migrated away from one another, they formed the Atlantic Ocean, for example, to the east of North America and South America, and the Southern Ocean. And so you can see how that breakup occurred. And scientists are quite convinced, only in the last 60 years or so, this is something fairly modern, something called plate tectonics, that this actually happened. Now, they surmise that the continents had been apart and came together to form Pangaea sometime in the misty, distant past. But there's no evidence of that in the Bible, of course. But this would be how the earth was divided. The explanations for that particular phrase, the only other explanation I've heard that made any sense was that in his time, the lands were divided and assigned to the people who spoke different languages, as in after the time of the Tower of Babel. But that's not, I think this is what we're talking about here. And there's a good reason for believing that there was a single landmass at the time of the flood that sometime later, a couple of thousand years probably, broke up and scattered the continents around the earth. And that is, if the animals all got off the ark at one place, they had to have some time to migrate to the various parts of the single continent then, so that when it broke up, they were carried along with the floating slabs of Earth's crust. Now, the crust floats on a liquid magma down below, and we know that. We're reminded of that every time we see a volcano spewing liquid rock into the air. All right, so that's kind of interesting, but it happened in Peleg's time. Well, if we look at this diagram that I gave you here, I have Peleg or Peleg. His lifespan is that red line up there. The length of the lines in each case is how long these people lived. And you'll notice that Shem is the longest individual life that we see there. And he outlived his son Arphaxad. and even outlived his grandson Canaan. But then we have Shelah and Eber, and something happened at the time of Eber. Can you see that from the length of the lives of these people? Now, Noah would have lived 350 years after the flood, and that would put him over dying around the year 2000. Right? 350 would be 2100. So, it just doesn't make much sense that he would live until the time that Abraham was born, if you follow that straight up the line there. But the curious thing about it is, if something happened in Peleg's time, it happened in the life of everybody else on that list. And that's not the impression that you get if something happened in his time. And so what I think we have here is a compressed genealogy, like the one in the first verse of the New Testament in Matthew 1 and 1. What does it say? Anybody remember what that verse says? The genealogy of Jesus, the son of David, the son of Abraham. You see what he's done? He goes on in the rest of that chapter listing all of the individuals in those gaps. But there was a sense in which Jesus was the son of David. That means his descendant. And the Hebrew, I don't think this is true in the Greek, but in the Hebrew, the word son, ben, as we know it, means either a son or a grandson or a descendant. And the word father, the Hebrew word is ab, or ab, Abraham, the father of many nations, the father of many peoples. Ab means both father and also ancestor. And so they don't distinguish between those uses. And so what I think we really should do here with this is to put Peleg in a time when he doesn't overlap with anybody else in that list. So Eber's down at the bottom, Peleg's in the middle, and Reu is up to the upper right, with some other individuals in between. This means that in his time really would be a time when none of the other individuals were alive. Okay? Even though we have very long lives up until the time of Eber. And then something happened. I think God made a distinction there, made a difference. These lives from Shem down to Eber are shorter than the ones before the flood. Most of those people live well past 600-700 years, and most of these all live less than 600 or 650. And so he's already made some sort of an adjustment so that people don't live as long. And what do you suppose that adjustment is? Well, we talked last week about the fact that the world got pretty scary after the flood. Before the flood, men lived essentially in an incubator where everything in their environment was quite benign. There weren't any storms. There wasn't a winter. There wasn't a summer. And everything was calm. There weren't volcanoes. There weren't hurricanes. There weren't tidal waves and things until the flood. And all of that stuff was unleashed at one time in the flood, as we talked about that a couple of weeks ago. So we have then, after the flood, God sends some of these events separately. Remember, what were the first four angels that sounded trumpets? What did they bring on from last week? First thing was a terrible storm, wasn't it? And the people were terribly afraid, the survivors were terribly afraid of the storms because they hadn't seen them before. And now all at once there were storms. And we live in an area of the world where we get storms. We haven't seen any bad ones lately, but from time to time we get tornadoes, we get lots of lightning and hail and floods and that sort of thing. And they were concerned about that. And so you remember in the story about the Tower of Babel, what did they decide to do? Going to build them a tower. Are they going to make it out of mud brick? No, they're going to bake the brick, if you read there, and put it together with asphalt, bitumen. They were trying to make a waterproof tower, it would appear. so that if the earth flooded again, they would have a place of refuge. And of course, God confused the language and they left off building that tower. Well, so that we had this terrible storm, and now we're having summer and winter. And I think the fact that the world is no longer such a kind place to live made their lives shorter. If you are put under stress fairly frequently, that probably shortens your life just within itself. So they had what else? They had a volcano blow up a huge mountain and throw it into the sea. They had an asteroid strike the earth, and then they had terrible air pollution. That in itself would do it. Living close to Houston, where we get all of the bus fumes, and anybody work in the ship channel area where they have all these petrochemical plants and all the stuff that spewed into the air, do you think that might shorten your life a little bit? And so I think the environment in which they were living was conducive to shortening the life somewhat. And then something spectacular happens after Eber, and that's what we're looking at in the ninth chapter. So let's get to that. So we've had four angels sound their trumpets, and the fifth angel in Revelation 9 sounds his trumpet. And I saw a star that had fallen from the sky to the earth. Now we saw wormwood, a star that fell to the earth and created a big disaster. But here we have a different situation. The star was given the key to the shaft of the abyss. So the star isn't a star. The star is a prominent individual, isn't he? He's going to take that key and open a lock somewhere. So it's a person. See, this is different. This is not something from the heavens. And in fact, he had fallen from the sky to the earth in the past. And this is Satan, of course, who was cast out of heaven. And we get to that in the 12th chapter of Revelation. We'll see the details of that as it had happened earlier. The star was given the key to the shaft of the abyss. When he opened the abyss, smoke rose from it like the smoke from a gigantic furnace. The sun and the sky were darkened by the smoke from the abyss. What is the abyss? What do we mean by that term? Do you ever approach an abyss? Did you ever see an abyss? It's a hole in the earth, isn't it? I think as we use it now. Some versions, and I think maybe the King James said bottomless pit, did it in some of its translations? And so let's look at some other verses. In Revelation 20, we'll get to this along about April. And I saw an angel coming down out of heaven, having the key to the abyss and holding in his hand a great chain. And in fact, this messenger is probably Jesus himself. He seized the dragon, that ancient serpent, who is the devil or Satan, and bound him for 1,000 years. He threw him into the abyss and locked it and sealed it over him to keep him from deceiving the nations anymore till the 1,000 years were ended. After that, he must be set free for a short time. That's a dire warning that if Satan's going to be, has been locked up, is going to be set free, then things are really going to get worse, aren't they? But clearly the devil was locked up in the abyss. And in Luke 8, you remember the story about Jesus healing a man who had multiple demons? What is your name? Legion, he replied, because many demons had gone into him. And they begged him repeatedly not to order them to go into the abyss. Jesus could have sent them to the abyss, and that may be where they wound up, because where did he allow them to go? Into some pigs, didn't he? A herd of pigs on the hillside. Pigs all ran down into the ocean and drowned, and I don't know where the demons went after that. They may have wound up in the abyss anyway. And there are other verses in the Bible that allude to the fact that the angels that sinned, I think that's in 2 Peter and in Jude, were locked away in darkness and chains. And so apparently this verse that we're looking at in Revelation 9, this abyss is full of demons. And Satan sets them free. And you want to know, well, why did God allow him to do that? Well, of course, he knew what Satan was going to do with these individuals. And Satan was going to do what he wanted to do all along, and that was attack humanity and kill them. Okay, he wanted to do away with man if he could, God's wonderful creation of a human being. And so he's going to attack them in some way, and I'm sure God knew exactly what was going to happen. Out of the smoke, now you open this up and you might think, well, you open up a big place in the earth and here comes like a volcano, lots of smoke and ash and soot and so on. But on the other hand, we're talking about another one of these situations where the abyss is in a direction we can't point. We can't go there and we can't find the abyss because it's not in three-dimensional space. It's sort of like when Jesus allowed John to turn around and see him. He had been there with him on the Isle of Patmos, but he couldn't see him until God gave him the ability to see in that direction. And here we have a situation like that. The abyss holds demons. I wonder how many. Well, we may get an idea here in a minute. And so here comes smoke out of the ground, like a gigantic furnace. And, of course, we built gigantic furnaces that give off lots of smoke. The sun and the sky were darkened by the smoke from the abyss. And out of the smoke, locusts came down upon the earth. What's a locust? It's a big old grasshopper. And we're talking about Middle East plague locusts here, and we'll talk about that in a minute. If you know a little bit about biology of grasshoppers, this whole reading makes a little bit more sense, and we'll talk about that. So they came down upon the earth out of the smoke, and they were given power like that of scorpions of the earth. They were told not to harm the grass of the earth or any plant or tree. So here are grasshoppers set loose upon the earth, but told not to eat anything green. Who's telling them not to eat anything? Well, the angel of the abyss turns out to be Satan. We'll see that in a minute. But here we have, they're not to harm the grass of the earth. And that doesn't mean they can't eat a blade of grass here and there. And as a matter of fact, these locusts generally are harmless on the crops and so on. They're green, like a large green grasshopper, and they eat a little bit of grass and a leaf here and there, but they don't generally do harm to crops. And people have known a long time about these green locusts, but it was only in about 100 years ago that they began to put together the problem of the locust-forming plagues. And we know about the plague of locusts in the time of Moses leading the children of Israel out of Egypt. And we'll see that in another setting, too, in the book of Joel. We'll talk about that one in a minute. All right. They were told not to harm the grass of the earth or any plant or tree, but only those people who did not have the seal of God on their foreheads. Who are those? Who are the ones who have the seal of God on their foreheads? The righteous, right? Is there any doubt about that? And so anybody that's not righteous is fair game. And they're going to be harmed by these insects. And they are. They're just insects. If a demon can occupy a pig, he can occupy a grasshopper. Okay? How big is a demon anyway? How many demons can dance on the head of a pin? Remember, there was a big question about that centuries ago. How many angels could dance on the head of a pin? How big are they? They were not given power to kill them now. So they can attack people who are not righteous, but they can't kill them. So there's a limitation placed on them, but only to torture them for 5 months. Can you endure 5 months of torture? Maybe some of you have. Pain and fevers and difficulties. Sometimes we get sick and are sick for a long time and endure. And these people were tortured by something here, and we'll see what it is in a minute. The agony they suffered was like that of the sting of a scorpion when it strikes a man. Are these locusts able to behave like scorpions? Do they have a sting on their tails? I don't think so, but there's something about their tails that they can inflict a wound on a person, and it looks like the sting of a scorpion. All right? We'll see about that in a minute, too. During those days, men will seek death but will not find it. That's pretty terrible, isn't it? They will long to die, but death will elude them. Okay? We know of a situation of a man who got into that circumstance, don't we? Job. And I think this is about the time, Eber is probably a contemporary or shortly thereafter, the time of Job, who was related to Uz. The Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? There's no one on earth like him. He is blameless and upright, a man who fears God and shuns evil. Is he righteous or wicked?" He's righteous. He's declared so by God, isn't he? Satan replied, "But stretch out your hand and strike his flesh and bones, and he will surely curse you to your face." That's a challenge, isn't it? The Lord said to Satan, "Very well then, he's in your hands, but you must spare his life." See, that's a limitation placed upon Satan at this time, just like the one placed upon the locusts. They could attack only the wicked, but not the righteous. So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord and afflicted Job with painful sores from the soles of his feet to the top of his head. Then Job took a piece of broken pottery and scraped himself with it as he sat among the ashes. And we look at that, and that's a terrible scene, isn't it? What did Job have? Well, doctors look at that and they say, well, it appears that he had something like a boil or a carbuncle, not just one, but all over his body, here, there, and everywhere else. And it looks very much like a scorpion sting, except a scorpion sting gets well right away, within a week or so. But this doesn't get well. It exudes pus, and it's terrible. But it doesn't kill him, okay? Eliphaz the Temanite said in Job 4, "Consider now who, being innocent, has ever perished. Where were the upright ever destroyed? As I have observed, those who plow evil and those who sow trouble reap it." And what's he saying? These kinds of things only happen to wicked people. Well, if we go back to chapter 9, that seems to be the case, that God has allowed Satan to attack the wicked, but not the righteous. And I think the answer to the problem about the story of Job is that Job was the turning point in that, when God finally allowed Satan to attack the righteous as well. No wonder his friends thought he had committed some terrible sin, because that had always been the case up until then. But of course, that's not in this story, but that helps us to understand the story of Job, perhaps. Now, the locust, he's going to do a description here. The locusts look like horses prepared for battle, but they're little horses. They're not great big horses, of course. On their heads, they wore something like crowns of gold. I'll show you that in a minute. And their faces resembled human faces. Well, they got big eyes, of course, but their hair was like women's hair, and their teeth were like lion's teeth. And so you look at a grasshopper. Now, the picture of the Middle East plague locust is pretty much like this, except for the hair. The antenna, he's talking about the antenna that stick out of the head of the locust, were short in modern locusts. But in the ancient times, they may have been much longer than that and folded back over the body of the locust. And there are grasshoppers like that even today. Well, let's take a look at that. Let's do some grasshopper biology here. On the left, these are young grasshoppers. Now, these are not mature. I'll show you a mature one in a minute. Their wings are short. They're just hopping around. The green ones are called solitary grasshoppers. They're solitary locusts. And it's a species called Schistocerca. Gregaria has to do with the fact that they form plagues and huge assemblages of these things. They're gregarious. Well, when the populations hatch out in dense numbers, when they go from green to red, black, and yellow, and form huge swarms, when they all hatch at one time and there are millions of them in a small plot of ground. And it happens when they rub together, when the grasshoppers keep encountering each other. Then they make a transition to the right-hand part, which is the colors that we'll see in the description in Revelation 9 in a minute. And in the upper right, you can see the crown. It says it looked like they had a crown upon their head. And you see it does look kind of like a crown between the eyes of the locust. Now, these are shorthorn locusts, but there are some that have much longer antennae than that. All right, so you can see the colors. The one here, I don't think in copying all of this I got the red right, but the yellows and the blacks. The blacks look purple in some light, and that's what we'll see here in Revelation. So it forms a swarm. When they get together, then it only takes a couple of weeks, and they all turn black, and they all mature, and then they all set off looking for food. Here's the big one. You can see his wing, which is spread out here. I think this one's probably dead, but they spread out the wings so that you can see that they can fly great distances. They can fly 1,000 miles. They get up on the wind and migrate. All they have to do is stay aloft, and then they can be carried by the wind. Now, they had breastplates like breastplates of iron. That's their carapace around their midsection. And the sound of their wings was like the thundering of many horses and chariots rushing into battle. They had tails and stings like scorpions. Now, it looks like a scorpion sting on the tail, but really it isn't a sting as such. And the tails, they had power to torment people for 5 months. They had as king over them the angel of the abyss, whose name in Hebrew is Abaddon and in Greek Apollyon. And those two words mean, in Hebrew and in Greek respectively, destroyer. And that's really clearly Satan. The first woe is past. Two other woes are yet to come. So we're going to see another sounding of a trumpet here in a minute. So these individuals form swarms, and as they rush into battle, he's talking about here, it's like a huge army overtaking them. Now, if you go to the book of Joel, you'll find these same phrases used to describe what's clearly a plague of locusts brought upon Israel because of their sin. The sixth angel blew his trumpet, and I heard a voice coming down from the horns of the golden altar that is before God, and it said to the sixth angel who had the trumpet, "Release the four angels who are bound at the great river Euphrates." And the four angels who had been kept ready for this very hour and day and month were released to kill a third of mankind. Now, the number of the mounted troops was 200 million. That's a lot. But it's common as far as locust swarms are concerned. Some locust swarms contain more than 1 billion individuals. I heard their number. But suppose there's one demon per locust. I don't know how many demons a single locust can carry. But it talked about the riders, the horses and their riders. The word of the Lord came to Joel, the son of Pethuel. "Hear this, you elders. Listen to all you who live in the land. Has anything like this ever happened in your days or in the days of your forefathers? Tell it to your children. Let your children tell it to their children," and so on. "What the locust swarm has left, the great locusts have eaten. What the great locusts have left, the young locusts have eaten. What the young locusts have left, other locusts have eaten." Those terms, four terms here, are the cutter locust, the swarmer, the larva, the stripping locust. That's how the Jews saw these individuals, and they could look at them and identify them. The young locusts were not quite mature, and there were other varying identifications for these different ones. what happens at the very end when all of the grass and leaves are gone, the locusts strip the bark off the trees. They'll take the bark off of all of the grapevines, and that kills the plants. It won't come back out after that. So this was a terrible plague. And Joel goes on, the whole book of Joel is about a situation like this where the people had sinned and God sent them this plague. And he describes them the same way they're described in chapter 9 of Revelation. And so we know that's what Revelation is about. In fact, anytime we're looking for where does this apply, it applies to some part of the Bible. And if you go there, you can get a better indication of what's being talked about here. Remember, we're talking about God's view of this in Revelation. Okay, that's what it looks like. And it's just an endless cloud of insects. Some kid out with a stick, looks like a broom, trying to hit them in the air. And of course, they pop when you hit them, and that was great fun. But what he didn't realize was his food's going to be gone in a matter of days. And for that reason, it's thought that God permitted the Israelites to eat locusts. That was because once everything else is gone, that's all there is to eat. And once that's gone, there's not anything to eat until the grass begins to grow and humans and animals and everybody suffers until the next round of rain and the grass sprouts somewhat. So you can easily see millions and millions and millions of individuals here. 200 million in the swarm described. So the number of the mounted troops was 200 million. I heard their number. And maybe that's the number. How many angels did we say were created in the beginning? A myriad of times a myriad, 10,000 times 10,000, which is 100 million, isn't it? And millions more than that. I think that was just to give us a great big number to shoot for. Doesn't tell us definitively how many. The horses and riders. So we know that the horse is the locust and the rider, I think, is the demon. The riders aren't mentioned anymore here. But there's something directing them, isn't there? I saw in my vision, they looked like this. Their breastplates were fiery red, dark blue, and yellow as sulfur. So they had gone through this transition and they had the three colors instead of being green. The heads of the horses resembled the heads of lions, and out of their mouths came fire, smoke, and sulfur. Those are things you might expect coming out of an abyss and out of the ground and out of the smoke. But they probably refer to something else. A third of mankind was killed by the three plagues of fire, smoke, and sulfur that came out of their mouths. Did you ever pick up a grasshopper and have it spit on you? Those of us kids who played with grasshoppers, it looked kind of like, we always thought it looked like tobacco juice, didn't it? It's something they exude. But they were exuding something, weren't they? The power of the horses was in their mouths and in their tails, for their tails were like snakes having heads with which they inflict injury. So here it's not just a scorpion, but a snake. So something comes out of the tail and something comes out of the mouth. And what I think we have here is the introduction of a bacterial disease. Several of them, as a matter of fact. To begin with, the green locusts lived without destroying the plants, but they exuded something from their tail, from their droppings, contaminated the agricultural materials that the people were collecting, wheat, barley, pomegranates or olives or whatever. And when they handled them, they got it on their bodies. And when you get a certain type of a bacterium that causes boils and carbuncles and that sort of thing on you, if you don't wash it off, you're likely to get those diseases. You might recall in the time of Moses, he threw dust in the air and out of this came boils and that sort of thing. So, as a matter of fact, these same kinds of plagues that we've talked about here that afflicted the earth after the flood, many of them are the same things that had afflicted the Egyptians later on in history. We saw things like storms and hailstorms, and we also saw ash, and the sky darkened so that it was dark for several days, and people afflicted with boils and other diseases. And so many of these same things God used there. And in fact, the darkness for several days, the darkness that could be felt was probably something that came out of the air like an ash. And it's thought that the island of Thera blew up at about that time. And the ash cloud drifted across the Mediterranean, and you can follow its path because it's a deposit in the bottom of the sea, and right across Egypt. And that was a huge mountain that was thrown into the ocean, just like the one described here. But the one we see in Revelation 9, one of these early events, was probably a different one in another part of their world. Well, why did this happen? Now, I was going to tell you about the three plagues. These are clearly diseases, aren't they? And if you get some of these bacteria, here we have, in addition to the sores on these individuals that lasted for 5 months, now we've got things that are killing them. Fire, smoke, and sulfur. What could those diseases be? Well, fire could be a fever, and smoke could be some sort of a lung disease, and sulfur would be something that attacked your liver and caused a jaundice, wouldn't it? And something like that. I think what we have here is a description of Satan inventing disease. Before the flood, man had a perfect immune system. He lived a long, long time. He never got sick. And after the flood, his immune system was still good for a long time, and it was difficult to get sick. But ultimately, after a few thousand years and some mutations had accumulated, the immune system wasn't quite so strong. And so Satan invented disease to shorten the life of man and to kill them. These are deadly diseases to kill one-third of the population. We don't know if only the ones who got infected were the ones who were killed, but we just simply aren't given enough detail there. But apparently that's the case. And why did God allow this to happen? The rest of mankind that were not killed by these plagues, now that's two-thirds of them that survive, still did not repent of the work of their hands. They did not stop worshiping demons. See, they're worshiping demons, as a matter of fact. And idols of gold, silver, bronze, stone, and wood, idols that cannot see or hear or talk or walk. And of course, the point was, you pray to your idol for deliverance from the disease, and they don't hear very well, do they? They don't do anything about it. And God's trying to get humanity to understand that. Nor did they repent of their murders, their magic arts, their sexual immorality, or their thefts. These were pretty neat guys, weren't they? They lived like that. That's terrible. And God was trying to get them to repent. That's why I said earlier I thought that the trumpet blasts were warnings and probably followed up by prophets who told them what was about to happen. And here, Satan inflicts a double penalty on these people. Plagues of insects and diseases. And they hadn't seen diseases like that before. And it might have been that Job was the very first one who was a righteous person who was afflicted by one of these diseases. And so that, no wonder his friends thought that was very strange, that a righteous person should have a disease. Well, that could be what happened after Eber, and it shortened the lifespan of man down to around 300 years. And beyond that, then we have the lifespan gradually shortening beyond that because of mutations in his immune system and in his body, and the wear and tear on yourself as you live in a world that is as violent as the world became. So you'll have kind of a summary of what we've talked about here on the back side of your handout today, and you can read that to remind you of what we talked about here. Do we We have just a few minutes if any of you have a question about this. I don't know of any other place in the Bible that goes into any kind of explanation about the origin of disease. But now when Jesus came, he does what is sinful is of the devil, because the devil's been sinning from the beginning. In 1 John, the reason the Son of God appeared was to destroy the devil's work. And so when he cured somebody of an infested demon living in him or a disease, he's destroying the devil's work when he cures somebody of either demons or disease, because they're related, as you can see. Anything else? Okay, Todd's going to take any prayer requests.